Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney, joining you from 1 mile high alongside my extremely attractive audio engineer. For your listening pleasure, so glad to have you back on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And I'm debating whether or not to start in the mailbag or to start with the police or where to go first. Well, let's start with some music. No, okay. No, we're not going to start with music. We're going to start from the mailbag. I got an email from a concerned listener in regards to the story last week about the heavy elements and where exactly they came from, specifically the gold. If you'll remember, I quoted some fantastical scientists on how the gold was formed by a combination of star collisions and meteorites and showers and all of that, as opposed to Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. And I do believe that I qualified my statement to cover only the heavy elements. You know, the radioactive stuff, uranium and things like that. But I said maybe the gold. Don't know where the gold came from. So I got this email from Russ in Alaska. We have listeners in Alaska. Isn't that impressive? He says, Doug, I'm not sure if you were serious about where the gold came from, but I think it's clear that gold was present on the Earth's surface before the flood. And then he goes on to have the audacity to quote the book of Genesis in the second chapter, as listeners of mine are wont to do from time to time. Genesis chapter 2, warning, 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 Will Robinson, there are Bible verses up ahead. For those in the audience who advocate pluralism and diversity, we know here at the Weekly Worldview that you would do just about anything to shut anyone up who would ever dare even think about the possibility of quoting a Bible verse in public. So this warning gives you fair notice that raw, unadulterated truth is about to be uttered. Genesis in the second chapter, a river watering the garden, that's the Garden of Eden, flowed from Eden. From there, it was separated into four headwaters. The name of the first is Pishon. It winds through the entire land of Hivalah, where there is gold. The gold of that land is good. Aromatic resin and onyx are also there. Unquote. That's quoting God in the Bible, as recorded by Moses. And I want to point out to Russ that I had a similar conversation with my pastor. And he was similarly, concerned about my position that possibly the gold and all the heavy elements were created during the event that led to the foundations of the great deep being broken open. Have I misstated that? The fountains of the great deep, thank you very much, the fountains of the great deep broke forth. And I just want to point out that the book of Genesis was written by Moses many, many, many years after the creation, and it could be that this reference to the river Pishon winding through the entire land of Havilah, where there is gold, it could be a modern reference, modern in the sense for Moses' modern audience back then, rather than a description of the timeline, if you know what I mean. Am I being clear? I don't think I am, because even I don't understand what I'm saying. What I'm saying is Moses may have been writing about the land of Havilah so that the people who were reading the book he was writing would have some idea about where this was. It's possible is all I'm saying. And I will go to my grave with the belief that the heavy elements and radioactivity indeed were the result of Walt Brown's hydroplate event, Fountains of the Great Deep event. And all I'm saying is it's possible that the gold came at that point too, and that Moses was just making a geographic reference so that his audience would have an idea of where this river Pishon was. And Russ concludes his email. He says, by the way, I am addicted to gold, and sometimes I entertain myself by trying to figure out where the river Pishon flowed and where that gold would be right now. So a listener to the show may be out there searching for the land of Havilah and the Pishon River. And, well, he's got a pan and a backpack. Keep an eye out from him. He's one of those fellows who looks like he's from Alaska. Very burly types up there, you know. All right, thank you. Thank you, Russ. I will continue to keep an open mind about the gold. Maybe it was there before the flood, maybe not. But certainly the heavy elements and radioactivity and uranium and all that stuff, it seems to make, Walt Brown's theory makes more sense to me than the astrophysicists, psychobabblers talking about stardust and all that stuff. All right. So there, we started in the mailbag. Now let's go to the police. I'm going to do this story first, but I don't want you people to think that I don't like the police. Police. Yeah. Well, that's how they say it in Louisiana and Alabama and certain parts of East Texas. It's the police. Look out. It's the police. Anyway, well, let's go to, well, this is Auburn, Alabama. From Reason.com is the website from which I pulled this story. This is from the Just a System file. Former Auburn police officer Justin Hanners claims that he and other cops were given directives to hassle, ticket, or arrest specific numbers of residents per shift. That's right. The old quota system that we've all suspected has been in place has been exposed by Officer Justin Hanners there in Auburn, Alabama. Hanners blew the whistle, according to Reason.com, on the department's tactics, and he was eventually fired for refusing to comply. He says that each officer was required to make 100 contacts per month. He said this equates to 72,000 contacts each year, and he noted that the population of the town is 50,000. Yeah, tell me about it, right? His claims are backed up by audio recordings that he made of his superiors giving him directives about this 100 contacts quota. And, well, he's now a former officer because he was fired. Hanners says that he believes that the quotas are entirely revenue-driven, have nothing to do with public safety or the prevention of crime or anything like that. It's all about the money. The industry of justice, a shameful industry. When justice becomes an industry, that's a shame. And it's immoral. And it's dangerous because it makes people not take the law and justice seriously when they think that they're just being ticketed just to rake in some dough for the municipality. I mean, we don't buy into that, and it undercuts our faith in the just a system. And my faith probably couldn't be undercut any further, but this story doesn't help. But let me tell you a story that does help. I had the most pleasant and most efficient interchange with a Colorado Highway Patrol officer that I have ever had this past week. I was driving out to the airport, minding my own business, and I was running just a little late from the time I had told a colleague that I would pick them up at the airport. I knew I was going to be a couple minutes late, and I hate to be a couple minutes late. When I tell somebody I'm going to be somewhere at a specific time, I like to get there at a specific time, and it seems like the older I get, the less and less likely that is to occur, and it annoys me. So I'm driving up 225, clogged in traffic. There's construction left and right, and I'm creeping along at 30, 32, 36 miles an hour. Finally, I get out onto I-70, I get a little bit of breathing room, I hit Pena Boulevard, and there's not a car to be seen. So things opened up ahead of me, and what did I do? Well, I opened up as well. So I was speeding along with my radar detector in place, firmly ensconced behind the rearview mirror, and I was going pretty fast. I don't know if I should say how fast I was going. No, let's not say, because I've already made a deal. They already know because he's got it on his little radar gun. Anyway, I come up over a rise and I see the officer pointing the laser device at me. And a moment later, my radar detector, it freaks out. And the thing about the laser on your radar detector is when the laser goes off, that doesn't mean you can avoid a ticket. That means you just got a ticket. Yeah, if it's some of the radar bands, the KA band, the K band, sometimes you can slow down. But when the laser hits you, forget. You're getting a ticket. So the first thing I did, of course, was remove the radar detector and hide it under the driver's seat. And then I pulled over, and I made sure I got to a place where the officer would be fully off the highway. I took an exit. I pulled into a little field, even, to make sure that he was safe. Why? Because I like police officers. I kept both hands on the wheel. He came up. He said, "Sir, do you know how fast you were going?" I said, "I'm not sure." He said, "Well, I clocked you at thus and such." And I said, "You know, officer, I didn't know the car would go that fast. That's actually encouraging, but I apologize." I said, "I was in a hurry. I'm on my way to the airport." He said, "I know." So from the time I gave him my license and registration and insurance to the time he released me on my own recognizance was less than 4 minutes. Now that is public service, ladies and gentlemen. Obviously, if I'm speeding to the airport, one can assume that I'm in a bit of a hurry. And this officer was very diligent in his efforts, and I just want to say thank you and hats off to whoever you were, because I do appreciate it. He also knocked down the speeding violation over 20 miles less than what I was actually doing, because he said, "If I actually give you this ticket, you're probably going to lose your license. So listen, here, I'm going to cut you a break." He wrote me the ticket, and I just have to pay some money, and I basically just have to lie in my testimony and claim that I had a defective vehicle, which is always handy. Anyway, thank you very much, officer. I do appreciate that, and I do appreciate the police being out there, because I know that they are the thin blue line between us and the dark side, and I'm thankful they're out there. And by the way, I will be watching my speed. Don't plan to be driving that fast again at all, ever. Thank you very much, officer. All right, now, but let's get to the more from the Just a System file. This is from News 10 out in Central California, Dateline Roseville, California. Some inmates are paying for jail, and they're being allowed to buy an upgrade to a nicer jail cell. Like first class, more leg room, right? Instead of that stainless steel toilet seat, right? In the wintertime, you can upgrade maybe to one of those padded, maybe a quartz, maybe. I don't know if they do toilet seats in quartz. But if they do, out in Roseville, California, maybe you can upgrade. So inmates pay $60 to the municipality for each 12 hours that they serve in jail. And listen to this. They don't have to serve all their jail time at once. If someone has to serve 30 days, let's say, well, they can take up to 90 days to serve it and space their sentence out over weekends and other days when it doesn't interfere with their lifestyle. Yeah, can you believe that? This is just a system. Now, the jail commander out in Roseville says that the program helps keep people employed because jail doesn't disrupt their job. So if you're throwing someone in jail, and it's meant to punish them and teach them a lesson, wouldn't the inconvenience of daily life be a part of that? This just proves that jail is putting people in jail as a punishment is a big lie, and it's counterproductive, and it's primarily revenue driven. Well, there's two things, I think. Revenue for the jail industry, that is a booming industry. There's that, and then there's the fact that liberals cannot impose just sentences on criminals because of their own guilt deep down in their black little hearts. They can't do it, so they throw people in jail and fine them and collect money from them and create an industry around so-called justice. Oh, one more thing from News 10 out in Roseville. One of the newest programs is a jail in Fremont where select inmates can pay $155 a night to avoid the jail in Oakland. So now we laugh about it, right? But can you imagine the tendency of the sentencing judge? If he thinks the perpetrator has any money at all, he'll just threaten to send him to Oakland, and the inmate will be, "Well, please, I'll do anything." Well, for $155 a night, you can get more leg room over in Roseville. And, of course, you won't be killed as you would be in Oakland. Let's see. Critics. There are some critics. They say that the pay for jail is an elitist program. So the liberals are upset because the rich can afford to go to Roseville, get more legroom, and meanwhile the poor are sentenced to Oakland or the dirtier low-rent cells over in Roseville. So they have a problem with what they perceive as class disparity in jail. But I don't have a problem with that. I don't really care about any of that. I have a problem with the fact that, once again, here, the government has made an industry of justice. And justice is not an industry. Justice is an obligation of the government. And justice should be blind. And all of that. And that's where I have a problem. And if I was in the unfortunate situation of having to choose between Roseville and Oakland, I admit that I would pay the money.
Spaces in between. I wanna live a life like that. I wanna be just like a king. Take my picture by the pool, 'cause I'm the next big thing in Beverly Hills.
All right, we're back. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Thank my audio engineer for all the work she does in the background, holding things together here around the McBurney compound. And she's extremely attractive. Had I mentioned that already? All right, we want to talk about black boxes. I was going to open with this, but somehow I got distracted with all this justice system stuff. From the New York Times, about 96% of all new vehicles sold in the United States have black boxes. Yeah. And they record a trove of data. And this data has raised privacy concerns amongst privacy advocates. Privacy. You know what a privacy advocate is? That's someone who makes a living speaking for other people who could speak for themselves. So I'm generally against advocates. So there. They say they have concerns to federal regulators, law enforcement authorities, and insurance companies. The data is an indispensable tool to investigate crashes. But to consumer advocates, the data is the latest example of the governments and companies having too much access to our private information. Once gathered, they say the data can be used against car owners to find fault in accidents or in criminal investigations. Okay, I'm having a hard time digesting this. The consumer advocates are upset because they could use the data against you. Let's say you were at fault in an accident and you lied. Let's say there was a criminal investigation going on and the black box could connect you to a crime. For some reason, these consumer advocates don't want the government or law enforcement to be able to do that. I'm not sure why that is. There's a Washington-based consumer group. A consumer group. They don't really buy anything. They just sit around and speak for people who really could just speak for themselves. This group is called the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC for short. I made that one up right here. EPIC. I did that myself. See, I could work for the government. I could be in charge of acronyms. EPIC. Let's see. They say without protections, these kind of black boxes can lead to all kinds of abuse. Yeah. Government officials have yet to provide consistent guidelines on how the data should be used. Perhaps they should hire me and my cousin and his brother-in-law, and we could work on guidelines. Perhaps. We are available. I mean, we work at the Privacy Information Center, but we have time for other jobs. If there was an opening and we could get that government contract, we would really appreciate that. That's my cousin and his brother-in-law as well. Yes, I have our resumes right here, as a matter of fact. Okay. So what these black boxes, which are similar to what are in airplanes, and they always, what happens after an airplane crash? What's the first thing everybody's looking for after they've accounted for all the people? Well, they're looking for the black boxes. Why? Well, the black boxes help you understand what happened in the crash. Apparently, they record things in a car, such as speed, braking, steering, time, and temperature, along with other electromechanical data. And I'm okay with black boxes, I think, as long as they don't record smells. That could be embarrassing, right? If that kind of, I wouldn't want anybody having that information. But other than that, if they don't record smells, I'm all for them. And here's why, ladies and gentlemen. We go to a story from mysanantonio.com, which is a news site, probably in San Antonio. This is from the Justice/Science file. A teenage motorist who is believed to have been racing when he caused a crash that killed two high school students has been indicted 5 months later on manslaughter charges. It took 3 months for police investigators to analyze wreck data from the black box in the offender's car. Investigators sent the perpetrator's computer, better known as a black box, to the manufacturer in order to track his actions before leading up to the fatal collision. And this data helped police determine that the perpetrator had indeed been speeding. He claimed he had not been speeding. And I guess privacy advocates would say he has a right to lie, and the police don't have a right to have data to look at. I heard a line the other night on some show that seems to make sense to me as far as the government and law enforcement capturing data. You know, everything that's been going on with the phone calls, the emails, the Facebook posts, the license plates. They're taking pictures of our license plates everywhere. They can tell. They can tell where we've gone. They can tell where we've been. So the line I heard another commentator say, and I don't remember who it was, but he said, if you're going to find a needle in a haystack, you need a haystack. And the data that the government is collecting is to me, it's the haystack. And then something bad happens or someone comes under suspicion. Well, now they have a haystack to go search and find the needle. But without the haystack, well, there you go. Anyway, I thought that was a good analogy. Maybe if I'm put in charge of acronyms, we'll find out who this other fella is, and he'll be put in charge of analogies. We could both work for the government. Get a big, fat government contract, big, fat government retirement plan, health care. It'd just be great. I guess that's all I have on that. So here's a black box invading this young man's privacy and preventing him from lying to authorities, and now he's been indicted. So I don't know if my car has a black box on it. My car's black. Anyway, if it does have a black box, I'm okay with that. And you can take pictures of my license plate all day long. I mean, whatever. I mean, who assumes that you have privacy when you're driving? Are we supposed to assume? Have you noticed that there's windows all the way the whole way around? Right? There's a big window in the front. Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, if you're picking your nose, I'm sure you do assume some level of privacy, but that would be a mistaken assumption. That's right. It's not private, folks. That's why there's windows all the way around the whole car. Okay? Anyway, just get over it. You don't have a right to anonymity, and you don't have a right to privacy when you're out in public. That's all. And that's my opinion. Although I do have a question about why was it that God got so upset with David when he numbered the people? God did not want David to number the people. I'm going to have to look into this because it could point out some hypocrisy in my worldview. So I'll have to ask my pastor why it is God did not want David to number the people. And does that have any application to modern day government? I have a feeling it does not. But still, I want to find out and I want to know. That's the cool thing about the Bible. No matter how much you read it, no matter how much you study it and talk about it, as you go through and live your life and experience things, There's always new information that can be mined from the Bible. Yes, data mining, so to speak, from the Bible. All right, now, we're speaking about bureaucrats. I want to talk about the National Transportation Safety Board. I've always gotten this confused with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. I've always wondered to myself, what? Are they? I mean, the National Transportation Safety Board and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. This is because someone had too many cousins and brother-in-laws at the Transportation Safety Board, so another department had to be created for various cousins, brother-in-laws, girlfriends, mistresses, whoever needed to be hired. But apparently, the board is a subsection of the Highway Transportation Safety Administration. You know what? I'm not sure, actually, now that I look at the story. I can't tell why they both exist, but apparently they're talking to each other. The NTSB has recommended that the NHTS, I'm sorry. And here I am wanting a job in acronyms. Come on. Because National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is almost Nazi. Almost is what I'm saying, okay? That just almost. They want the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to develop standards for wireless components that could let vehicles communicate on the road. Yes, they say that with those standards in place, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration can then require this technology to be installed on all vehicles. Yeah, and now there's another bureaucracy involved here, and this is a bureaucracy created by private industry. The Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. You see, when there's giant bureaucracies like the NTSB and the NHTSA, well, the private industry has to protect themselves, and they have to create a bureaucracy so that their lawyers can talk to the government lawyers and hopefully pay off the right person and avoid any problems. So the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers is the car business's answer to the NTSB and their sister organization, the Nazis. Actually, it's NHTSA. NHTSA, yes. We won't say Nazis. So they want to connect vehicles by Wi-Fi. They want Wi-Fi-like components that send electronic data messages back and forth and translate the data into hazard warnings for drivers, focusing on safety at intersections, lane changes, and rear-end accidents. They say we need to understand how to apply the technology in an effective way in the real world. That's according to a NHTSA administrator named Dave. He says, we need to understand. No, Dave, over at NHTSA, you don't need to know. Businessmen and car makers need to know. Okay, you shuffling papers in Washington, D.C., you knowing anything doesn't help any of us in any way. But I have to admit that your ideas sound good, that cars could actually stop from hitting one another with sensors and Wi-Fi. I think all that's completely possible. I think it's a great idea. But the fact that Dave has it deep in the bowels of the NHTSA building, that doesn't help anybody. But see, he thinks that everything comes from NHTSA. Yeah, he thinks that everything good that can happen in automobile safety is directly related to his patronage job in the government. Anyway, so let's follow up on this, ladies and gentlemen, with what's happening in private industry regarding technology focused on car safety. Well, this year, according to capradio.org, I don't know who these people are, but let's assume that they're a reliable news source. They say this year's version of the car of the future is a particular Ford Explorer that they had some experience with, and they said that this Ford Explorer activates a park assist system. That's right. The car itself scans the curb for parking spots. Then it tells the driver to take your hands off the wheel and put the car in reverse.
I like that.
Oh, yeah. This is great. For all of us who white-knuckled it through the parallel parking portion of the driving test, can you imagine sending your kid to her driving test with this car? And the driving instructor, this is the one place that they can trip you up, right, is the parallel parking, especially girls, right? I mean, let's admit it, folks. I don't mean to be sexist, but come on. So can you imagine, I send my daughter down when she's 16 to get her license, and right when he thinks he's going to trip her up, bop, she takes her hands off the wheel. And here's what happens, folks. You take your hand off the wheel, take your foot off the gas, and the car steers itself into a parallel parking space. Yeah. Now, that's what's happening in private industry as the government, bureaucrats, Dave and his friends, his cousins, brother-in-laws, mistresses, and other associated bureaucrats, come up with, think about these wonderful ideas about auto safety and Wi-Fi. Meanwhile, Google has cars that drive themselves. Cap Radio goes on, self-driving cars could catch on once drivers are comfortable with giving up control. And let me be the first to volunteer. If you have a self-driving car, I am in. These folks over here at Cap Radio, I don't know, they must be something about automobile advancements. They say that we may even have flying cars in about 10 years, which is very exciting. There already is a flying car, the Terra Fuji. I reported on here at least 2 years ago. I was looking at it with my daughter. My daughter's going to turn 12, so we're already anticipating what is her car going to be. At least she's anticipating it quite a lot. She doesn't realize that it's going to be the 99 Tacoma that's parked in the driveway right now. She has her sights set on the Terra Fugia, which is a car that you can fly out of an airport. It's really cool. But I have a quote here in the article from the deputy director of the California Department of Motor Vehicles. He says that by the end of this year, we hope to have regulations in place to allow for different manufacturers to test their autonomous vehicles on our roadways. And by January 2015, we will be done with the regulations that will define the operation of these vehicles on our roadways. As he shuffled his papers and adjusted his glasses and his pocket protector. Hey, stupid. The regulations that you write in your pathetic little cubicle are not going to define how autonomous vehicles operate on our highway. No, businessmen, car makers, people who work with their hands and get greasy, people who can read a slide rule, people who work for a living are going to determine and define how autonomous vehicles operate on our highways. And they'll only be able to do it if you'll stay in your office and get out of our way. Rarely have so many words been uttered in the introductory stanza of a song. Rarely have so many words been uttered and actually meant absolutely nothing than as that song right there, which makes it fun. At least it's not offensive on its face, like so many things out of the rock and roll genre. All right, now, from the Science Really file. Scientists in Germany, according to the Daily Mail, have succeeded in stopping light for an entire minute. Ah, this is really cool. Researchers achieved the remarkable feat by trapping light inside a crystal using a technique called electromagnetically induced transparency. Now, I was going to get into how this works, but I have a feeling on the radio that you can't follow it. So I'm going to put a link up to the story. This is really cool. Why? I'm not sure, but if you stopped light, well, that's pretty cool. I mean, I got to give you kudos. So a bunch of professors, PhD students, and all these guys, they stopped light and they held it inside of a crystal for a minute. And the results, according to the Daily Mail, may further light-based research and could make it possible to store data within beams of light, which could then be sent over long distances. It could also give experts clues on accelerating light beyond what is thought now to be the universal speed limit, which is light, 186,000 miles per second, I think. 186,000? 186 million? No, 186,000 miles per second. Well, you'd think I would have looked that up before I went on the air so I could sound reasonably intelligent. Anyway, light moves very, very fast. And stopping it is very cool, and I'm sure it's going to be helpful in some way. This idea of light-based data storage, well, that sounds pretty good to me. I mean, there's an awful lot of data that we're all generating all the time, and well, it needs to be stored and it needs to be transmitted. So if that helps, that'll... You know, it could also give us some insight into cosmology. If we're able to hold light in one place and really look at it, it could be really neat. Anyway, I'll keep an eye on that for you. You, ladies and gentlemen, go on about your daily lives. I'll keep an eye on these stories for you so that you can continue to be productive and raise your families and all that good stuff. Now, that was a scientist stopping light. Now let's move to another story from the Science Really file. This is a story out of Rjukan, Norway. I almost said Norwegia. That would be embarrassing, Norwegia. From Rjukan, it's RJ. How do you pronounce RJ? R-J-U-K-A-N. Rjukan. Maybe it's just Juken. Juken, Norway. And, Juken, Norway is a town that is shrouded in darkness for 5 months every year. You know, it's Norway. It's way up there in the if it's not in the Arctic Circle, it's right up there close to it. So for 5 months a year, they're shrouded in darkness. The town happens to be encircled by sun-obstructing mountains. And people say it's a dreary place to be between September and March when the sun's rays cannot reach the streets of the town of Rjukan, Norway. So in a new effort dubbed the Mirror Project, this project is designed to illuminate the town square of Rjukan with sunlight. How are they going to do it? Well, they've installed 538-foot mirrors throughout the mountain range. They were installed in the mountains in July by helicopter. And the town's residents and science lovers around the world will be watching to see if they can really keep the town lit up. So the mirrors are going to bounce the light from out where you can still get some light through the mountains, off the mirrors, and down into the town square of Rjukan, Norway. And so they're going to try to keep the town from its typical winter gloom. The idea was actually conceived by a Norwegian industrialist almost 100 years ago. Yeah, see? See how long it takes for a governing body like a municipality in Norway to catch up with the idea of some guy, some private guy, 100 years ago? If they would have just let him put his mirrors up, I don't know, you'd have had to use donkeys or something back then. I don't think they had helicopters 100 years ago. Well, anyway, we'll all be waiting on the edges of our seats, on the edges of our collective seats, to see this coming September if the town square of Rjukan, Norway, can be lit up by mirrors reflecting light through the mountain range. So there's really no moral to the story. I just think it's neat that they're trying to do this. And if I live there, I know I would probably want some sunlight in my town square. And we wish them the best of luck with all that. All right, now let's go to CBS in Washington from the Science Really file. Dateline Washington, a new poll finds that a majority of Americans believe that God played a part in the evolution of humans. That's right, shock and awe. A majority of Americans believe God played a part in evolution. 62% of Americans, according to some survey by an outfit I never heard of, 62% of Americans believe God created human beings. Okay? Now, 37% of that 62% believe God created human beings in their present form within the last 10,000 years or so. So put me in that group. I'm 37% of the 62% there. Maybe that could be our slogan. We're 32% of the 70. No, I got the number. We're 37% of the 62%. Go, team, go. I don't know. So that's us. We're considered radicals. Now, 25% of the 62% of Americans who believe God create or helped create humans, 25% of that 62%, believe human beings evolved from some lesser life forms over millions of years, but that God guided the process. And only 21% of those, well, that doesn't work, says 21% believe that God did not play a part in human evolution. But so maybe, I don't know, maybe that 21% is a whole outlier group. Those are the heathens, the Hail Satan crowd out there. You know, the ones who wear tampons on their ears and throw feces on people who disagree with them? Yeah, the Hail Satan crowd, that must be them. Let's see now. 17% of those, that's too many percentages. I mean, you get into like your fourth or fifth set data set of percentages, and I mean, people listen on the radio. Hey, can I get your attention back here? I know you were falling asleep there, for crying out loud. But listen, this is important. 17% of those polled were not sure if God played a part in the existence of humans. Okay, so let's analyze these numbers. 17% say they're not sure. Well, that 10 to 20% of the population, it's always been my contention, are complete zombies who are really, I mean, they're lucky that they survive in daily life. They're really stupid people. And these are the 17% who say they're not sure if God played a part in the existence of humans. They will always be with us. They are the terminally stupid, and I've always thought that they were the 10 to 20%. They were about 10 to 20%. I call them the zombies that everybody's afraid of, the zombies. Well, they're among us, and they come through in this poll at about 17%. All right. Now, the 30%, the 37%, no, here it is, I'm sorry, 25%, believe, I'm sorry, these percentages are mixing me up, for crying out loud. 25% believe human beings evolved from lesser life forms over millions of years, but God guided the process. Okay, that correlates to my general worldview that about 20 to 30% of the population are what I would call the low information left. They're not sure if there's a God, but if there is, they don't appreciate it, and they really don't look into anything much past the tip of their own nose. And they're completely self-absorbed, and they're the low information left. So combine them with the zombies, and you're looking at, what, 30 to 50% of the population, for crying out loud. Practically a majority are detrimental to the future existence of humanity. So all that's left to rescue humanity from 1,000 years of darkness is the 37% of those who believe God created human beings in their present form within the last 10,000 years, and this also correlates with another axiom that I've held, that about 30% of the population can actually be relied upon, right? To do something, to think something, to actually be creative, to actually be able to process data in a rational manner and come to reasonable conclusions. That's only about 30% of the population. Now, I know I've only accounted for 80% of the population, but I just can't go forward with any more percentages. Look, my extremely attractive audio engineer is starting to nod off over here. Who can follow these numbers? Basically, folks, there's only about a third of us who have any smarts at all, and the rest of those slackers are relying on you and me. We have a tremendous responsibility to these poor saps. Yeah. Well, and I believe that it's through no effort of my own that I've become a part of the approximately 30%. I think it's because I got to know the Creator, I got to know His Son, Jesus Christ, and I read His Word, and that makes me smarter than the average bear. That's all. It's not because of me, it's because I'm getting my information from the original source. Yeah, original thought, you might say. There you go. All right. Now, let me take a sip, because we're going to go to Fuller Evangelical Seminary. And we're diving into the bad religion file, as you could tell. We're going to Fuller Theological Seminary. They have, over at Fuller, they have given their approval to a new campus club for homosexuals. This is at a theological seminary, okay? The group is calling itself One Table. Yeah. That's the name of this homo group at this theological seminary. The homosexual group explains on its website that it exists to support the LGBTQ community at Fuller Seminary, while also offering a safe place for dialogue between LGBTQ students and the wider Fuller community, unquote. That's a statement on their website. Let's see here. The founder of this group, and its only known member, has come to the conclusion that he does not have to give up his homosexual lifestyle to be a Christian. Uh-huh. Here's what he says. He says, quote, "It quickly became apparent to me that I was going to be okay and that I wasn't going to have to forsake my faith for my sexuality," unquote. That's an awful lot of I's and I's and me's and mine's in there for a guy describing his relationship with Jesus Christ, with God. Kind of all about, I don't have to give up my sexuality for my faith. What's this fella's name? Should I say his name? Well, I can't find it. Anyway, he told the Associated Press he hopes to expand the attitude into the Fuller, to expand that attitude into the Fuller community. Well, he said, "I really hope that people will see Fuller and One Table as a model for what the body of the church is supposed to do in this situation." What exactly is that situation, young man? I just really need to meet somebody.
Ew,
just want to meet someone, that's all. I'm sad, I'm lonely. A school official there at Fuller, the one who oversees approval of Fuller's student groups, insists that allowing this man to have his One Table group on campus, he says that does not equate into acceptance of homosexuality by the seminary. No, there's a million other things that point to the acceptance of homosexuality at Fuller, as well as other diabolical theological deceptions at Fuller Theological Seminary. It's a. By the way, Fuller is 66 years old this year. Yeah, oddly enough. Yeah. Fuller's new president has issued a statement in an attempt to clarify the school's somewhat muddied position on homosexuality. See, if you're a theological seminary, let me break in with some commentary. If you're a theological seminary and your position on homosexuality appears to be muddied, well, you should close your doors and get into another business. I mean, I don't know. Sell high fructose corn syrup. Do something meaningful, because what you're doing is not productive. Here's what the new president of Fuller says. Fuller's position on same-sex marriage and behavior affirms that every person at Fuller is expected to abide by the community standards that premarital, extramarital, and homosexual forms of explicit sexual conduct are inconsistent with the teachings of Scripture. I hope this position is clear, unquote, he said, and it's not, because he talks about the community standard. Is that what you teach at Fuller Theological Seminary, the community standard? Well, what if we're in the Castro District in San Francisco? He says that these deviant types of sexuality are inconsistent with the teaching of Scripture. No, they're not inconsistent. They're actually condemned as sinful by the teaching of Scripture. Condemned as sinful. That would send all the seminarians for their dictionary trying to look up, what is condemned and sinful? What do these words mean? All right, now don't you think that might be considered disrespectful to our friend there at Fuller? I was trying to find this guy's name who started this group, but I just... Oh, Nick Palacios. Nick Palacios is the founder and only known member of One Table at Fuller, hence the reason it only takes one table. That's all they need at their meetings, because it's just him hoping to meet someone. All right. Now, from the bad religion file over at Fuller, let's go to the good religion file. Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Reyes is a Christian chaplain in the U.S. Air Force. And he recently wrote an essay entitled No Atheists in Foxholes, Chaplains Gave All in World War II. As reported by Breitbart, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, MRF, contacted the base commander demanding he take action against the chaplain for what they called an anti-secular diatribe. So MRF sent a letter to the base commander stating that Reyes' use of the bigoted, religious supremacist phrase, no atheists in foxholes, defiles the dignity of service members, and they accuse him of violating military regulations. So Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Reyes, Air Force chaplain, has been MRFed. He's been MRFed. Oh, you're not familiar with MRFed. Oh, well, you must not be from South Buffalo. So in South Buffalo, let's just say you're leaving a gin mill at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and you're tipsy, and suddenly you're attacked, beaten, and your wallet is stolen, and you're left in a puddle of rain and your own urine on the street. You've been MRFed. Okay, just to explain, and I think that's an appropriate acronym for this organization, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. Yeah, they're trying to MRF Chaplain Reyes. 5 hours after MRF's complaint, the essay was removed from the website and the base commander profusely apologized to MRF. But the apology and the abridgment of the colonel's free speech are apparently insufficient for MRF. Because now they say Lieutenant Colonel Reyes must be appropriately punished. That's right. They won't stand by with just squashing our free speech, ladies and gentlemen. The heathens don't just want the Christians to shut up. They want to put us in jail, and eventually they will want to kill us. And if at all possible, they would crucify us if given the opportunity. That's why this is a serious battle, ladies and gentlemen. I know right now in America, we don't have to worry about the heathens having us arrested and put in jail, but around the world, it happens quite often. And in some places, in the Sinai Peninsula, right now, there are Christians being crucified by satanic Islamist maniacs. And don't be surprised if in your children's lifetime that it becomes a crime to be a Christian in Cleveland or Cincinnati or Sacramento or Dothan, Alabama. I mean, just don't be surprised, ladies and gentlemen, if the 30% of us who actually have a relationship with the Creator and have some semblance of reasonableness, if we don't stand up and stop what's going on, then our children, or perhaps our grandchildren, could be arrested, thrown in jail, and perhaps even executed for simply believing and preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. So I take this very seriously, and I refuse to be MRFed. Okay? Now, MRF, by the way, is activist Mikey Weinstein's organization. He calls observant Christians fundamentalist monsters. He say we seek to impose a reign of theocratic terror. He describes the sharing of the gospel of Jesus Christ as an act of spiritual rape. And he says believers are enemies of the Constitution who are committing acts of sedition and treason against the nation. I know it sounds outlandish now, but what about 50 years from now if the homosexuals and the deviants and the atheists and the criminals and the drug peddlers are allowed to continue on their current trajectory? This will not sound so outlandish to the people who arrest your grandchildren and mine. Okay? That's just a warning. Breitbart reports that the Obama-Hagel Defense Department and the Air Force have met with Weinstein and MRF several times over the period of the past 4 years, and they say there's no problem with suppressing religious speech in the military. some people in the House of Representatives disagree and they're going to try to do something, but I don't know. I don't know how we solve this problem of the heathens. I guess we just have to evangelize them and hope for the best. And if all else fails, dig a moat and pull up the drawbridge if you have to. I don't. All right. Now from the bad religion. Oh, that was the good religion file. I'm sorry. I was talking about Murph and Mikey Weinstein, so I thought bad religion. But actually, that story was about Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Reyes, Christian chaplain, U.S. Air Force, the good religion file. No atheist in foxhole. Never has a more true statement ever been uttered. And I believe it was uttered by the President of the United States, if I'm not mistaken. I believe it was Harry Truman who was quoting. No, it was Dwight Eisenhower who was quoting a Catholic priest who had served time in World War II. Yeah, no atheists in foxholes, he said. Mikey Weinstein, that drives him insane. To think that people who were getting shot at might start thinking about God. What he wants is for people to just start shooting up and forget about God. Go to the back of the bathhouse and shoot up and don't worry about God. Well, Mikey Weinstein's never been in a foxhole. And so, and I'm sure he spent his entire life assiduously avoiding thinking about God and heaven and hell and judgment and all of that. But that does not negate the fact that he will stand before the living God and face judgment. It's not going to be a pretty day for Mikey Weinstein and his ilk. Now, to the misapplied religion file, this is from Concord, New Hampshire. School officials have told the mother of two high school students that she may no longer deliver prayers on the front steps of the Concord High School. She goes there every morning and prays and reads the Bible, and they've kicked her off. You know, I appreciate it, Mom, but what the hell are you doing sending your kids to the government schools in the first place? I'm sorry, I don't mean to. Was that profanity? I get rather upset about this. Here's a woman who sends her kid into the belly of the beast and then goes prays at the mouth of the beast. Come on, Mom, don't be an idiot. So she's been kicked out, told she can't come on the property anymore. Why? Because it's the temple of Satan. Should be obvious to you, Mom, why you can't go pray at the school. They're hell-bent on destroying your children and devouring them. Molesting them, defiling them, and devouring them. And you want to go pray at the steps of the death camp? Come on. Let's see, I'm running out of time. Army Major Nadal Hassan may become the next resident of the death row in the military. If he's convicted in the shooting rampage at Fort Hood, if he's convicted and sentenced to death, if, and that's a pretty big if. But here's the rub. The U.S. military has not executed one of its own since 1961. There's a whole bunch of guys on death row in the military, but they just can't seem to execute them. So Major Nadal Hassan will no doubt die of old age, or perhaps syphilis in prison. Because they're all heroes. That's it. That's what I forgot. I forgot these people were in the military. Hey, Nadal Hassan. Hey, he served. We should thank him for his service. He's a great American and a hero. Yeah. Thank you for pointing that out, dear. I'm probably going to have to close with this because I'm running out of time. But I'm going to do a show with Bob Enyart this week in which I will use some of this news that I wasn't able to get to. Because some of it is too complicated for a simple-minded fellow like me, and I need the advice of a guy like Bob to help me out with this stuff. But let's go to the personhood file before I say goodbye. From the personhood file, this is from, this was posted on National Partnership. It's about a Time Magazine article. So-called personhood amendments are creating a rift amongst abortion rights opponents, and in some cases are pushing pro-life advocates to adopt a more extreme message. Such amendments typically seek to grant human embryos the same rights as people. Well, they got that right, at least. That's what we want to do. Those who support personhood amendments aim to outlaw all abortions. Check that one off. That's correct. And they view anything less than a total ban on abortion as surrender. Now, that is hyperbole because we do not believe that. We believe that there are incremental steps that could be taken morally, and we're willing to accept those. For example, let's say North Dakota bans all abortion in the upcoming vote in November. Well, that wouldn't ban abortion in South Dakota. So one might say that's an incremental step, but that's an incremental step that we in the personhood movement are willing to live with as we launch a full frontal assault on abortion and stopping it everywhere for all time, which nobody's going to be able to do except Jesus Christ. But he is going to do it. He is going to stop abortion once and for all time. And since we are his body and his hands and his feet, we're down here doing as much as we can to get you people there before he comes, because he is not going to be happy when he gets here with you people. All right. Matt Sandy, the legislative director for Pro-Life Wisconsin, which is pushing for a personhood amendment in the state, says there are, he says, quote, there are lots of folks, even in the pro-life movement, who believe that there should be exceptions. Exceptions in the case of abortion. So there is going to be some tension in the pro-life movement over personhood. But he says the incremental approach is not working. The number of abortions is climbing over time. We need to end abortion without exception, without compromise, and without apology. And that's what personhood does. Well, and the crowd went wild. Way to go, Matt Sandy. I like this fella. Now, Wisconsin Right to Life, which is a sycophant organization of the National Right to Life Committee, there, which is the nation's largest alleged anti-abortion group, they opposed the personhood amendment in, was it Wisconsin? Must be getting to the end of the show. I can't remember where I'm. Yeah, Wisconsin. I should have never doubted myself. I am a professional. Even though I don't take a salary for this show, I want you people to be clear on that. I do this out of the goodness of my own heart because I'm genuinely concerned for the future of mostly me and my family, but you and yours too. That's why I do it. No, and don't send any donations. I'll refuse them. Maybe food items I might take, you know. Nope. Hillshire Farms, Pepperidge Farms, what is it? What's that thing that people send, the boxes of meat? You wouldn't take one of those? I always like the summer sausage. What's that? Yeah, if you want to send a donation, send it to American Right to Life, okay? Now, where was I with National Right to Life? Oh, yes, they oppose personhood amendments, raising concerns about money, time, and whether it will harm efforts to ban abortion over the long run. The group's legislative director, Sue Armacost, said, quote, this particular measure might sound good from a pro-life perspective, but it's not going to save one single life. And she should know, right? National Right to Life are the experts at passing laws that don't save a single life. If there's anyone who would know, it would be this late. And we know that passing the personhood law, that's not necessarily going to save anybody because someone has to implement it, right? I mean, I'm not naive. I don't think we're going to change the law and suddenly Barack Obama is going to personally walk to every abortion clinic in Washington, D.C. and slap a padlock on the door. I know that. What I want to do is provoke the confrontation. I want to fight about it because people are being killed. I want to fight them about it. And this personhood will provoke that confrontation, and we'll just see where it goes from there. I say bring it on. National Right to Life. You bunch of chumps. They've all bought into the idea that we have to tolerate the regulation of the killing of certain kids, that there just is no way we can hope to stop it all. Now, when it comes to other issues like slavery and puppy stomping, everybody's certain that we can actually stop it all, but for some reason, the killing of innocent children, we think, well, we never get away with stopping it all. That's a very extreme position. All innocent people should have the right to life? Well, I don't know. You want to return us to the 50s or something? Or the 1750s. So we've been warned by National Right to Life that personhood won't... And Americans United for Life, Susan B. Anthony Lift, they've also distanced themselves from the personhood movement. And instead, they're working to target voters who believe that abortion should be legal in some, but not all cases. This is incredible. For the first time, these national pro-life industry groups have admitted that they are not pro-life, that they do accept some abortion. You know, what I like about this Time Magazine article is it draws the line. So those of you who want to support the well-regulated murder of innocent people in some cases, you go support AUL, Susan B. Anthony, National Right to Life. Go ahead. You send your money there. Those of you who want to end abortion, American Right to Life, Personhood USA, send your money there. And let's get it on. Let's go. North Dakota is the state, according to this story from nationalpartnership.org. North Dakota is the state closest to adopting a personhood amendment. In November 2014, voters will decide whether to give it final approval. And, of course, we hope that they do allow the citizens to vote, just so, if nothing less, that there will be a record of everybody's opinion on the regulation of the killing of innocent people. All right, finally, ladies and gentlemen, from the Queering of Everything file, I save this for the end, because I do too many of these homo stories in my extremely attractive audio engineer tends to leave the room. The Oxford University Press says that they continually monitor the words in their dictionary, paying particular attention to those words whose usage is shifting. And they say that they anticipate there will be a shift in the definition of one particular word in the not-too-distant future, and that word is marriage. Yeah. Now, it's interesting to go through the definitions of marriage in modern-day reference materials, as this story from WorldNet Daily does. The Canada Space Dictionary says marriage is, quote, the state of being a married couple voluntarily joined for life or until divorce. That's the Canadian Space Dictionary. I think that only applies if you're a Canadian on the space station. I'm not sure. Google defines marriage as the formal union of a man and a woman. Holy cow. Google? Well, there's an editor. As soon as this story hit, they had some queer lisping editor in there changing that. Wikipedia calls marriage a social union or legal contract between people called spouses that establishes rights and obligations. Oxford says marriage is the formal union of a man and a woman, typically recognized by law, by which they become husband and wife. That's Oxford. Merriam-Webster, state of being united to a person of the opposite sex as husband or wife. Activists are demanding that dictionary definitions be changed. Of course. We have a quote from an activist. By correcting the definition of marriage, we could affect legal arguments. We could affect the naysayers' perceptions. We could raise awareness in a positive way and reinvigorate the energy of those who would like to see a different, better world. And we can finally call gay marriage what it should be called, marriage. Unquote. Get out of here, you little pervert. Anyway, that they're on the Full Court Press, ladies and gentlemen. We need to be on our toes, not on our heels, not apologizing for what God defined before there was a dictionary. He said it was one man and one woman, and that's marriage. And that's the show, folks. I'll be back with you next week. I want to thank my friends at American Right to Life, Personhood USA, Denver Bible Church, TheologyOnline.com. Is there anyone I forget? As always, my other brother, Darrell, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview Studio, should the Lord tarry. I'll bring you another broadcast next week, and until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.